Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting EXIT PLAN with no spaces to 44222. That's EXIT PLAN to 44222. Again, text EXIT PLAN to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me once again today. Pleasure to have you with me. We have an interesting lineup of guests, so we're going to get right to it this morning. My first guest today is Jennifer Peek from Peek Advisory. And Jennifer's got an interesting background we're going to hear about, and she can help you learn more about protecting and growing your business. And she has extensive experience in behind-the-scenes tactics of startup growth, acquisitions, and divestitures ranging from small companies to billion-dollar companies. And she provides expertise as a CPA, a Certified Public Accountant, a Certified Valuation Analyst, or CVA, venture investor, business owner, and consultant. She also is a commercial real estate investor and has owned two companies and currently serves on the board of ZNRG, Inc., an advisory board member of Foundation for Domestic Violence Prevention, and two privately held companies. She's a very busy lady. We're really pleased to have you on the show today, Jennifer. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jennifer, before we get into our discussion today, tell me a little bit about you and your background, and give our listeners a sense of what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. So you touched on a few of my elements of my background. I'll go over those a little bit more. I am a certified public accountant, and I'm also certified to do business valuations. Both of those things fit very nicely into the consulting and advisory work that we do with our clients. And we don't have to use them on every client, but they're highly valuable in all of the aspects of the work that we do. Backing up a little bit, I started out my career in public accounting as an auditor, and then did that for about 5 years, and then I moved to a Fortune 50 company where I worked for over 15 years. And during my time there, I worked both on the day-to-day accounting and financial reporting, as well as serving a role in the majority of the mergers and acquisitions that the company did. So those are definitely the elements of my billion-dollar experience more than my smaller to mid-sized company experience. But the value from participating in those transactions was really starting to understand the process and knowing where options and opportunities were going to exist and where things could really go wrong. So that is the experience that I then took with me when I started my own company about 9 years ago.
And
on
I noticed
personal
on your
side, yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Go right ahead.
All I was going to say
Finish
was
up.
on the personal side. On the personal side, I live in Kansas City, so right in the middle of the United States, and my husband and I are getting ready to be empty nesters. So I'm sure there'll be plenty of things to come with that.
Well, a lot of our listeners have that in common with you. You know, I was looking at your website, and it looks like you promote that you work very heavily with women-owned businesses, and that number of women-owned businesses is really on the rise. Why do you enjoy working with women-owned businesses so much?
You know, there's a couple of reasons. One is because I own a women-led business, and the folks that work for me are primarily females. But the other thing that I have found is that as there have become to be more and more women business owners in every industry that we've worked with, there is some catch-up that's going on, if you will, in terms of women looking more strongly at building full companies and eventually building those companies to an end, which I think is something that you didn't necessarily see 10 to 15 years ago. And the great part about working with those women business owners is that it really does help them create a legacy of the company that they're building and move into that next stage of whatever it is that they want to do. We find a lot of our business owners have some element of being a serial entrepreneur in one way or another. And it's always great to see people be able to complete one business, hand it off to the next generation, if you will, whomever that may be, and do the next thing that excites them.
Great answer. You know, I'm wondering, because I work a lot with business owners of all types, you know, and I was wondering, is there a higher propensity of women-owned businesses in your research to continue the business as a legacy business, pass it on to family members? Is there any delineation there between male-owned businesses and female-owned businesses?
You know, I haven't really seen any to date. I do think that there is a focus of women business owners on what that legacy is going to be, more so than I've seen it with male business owners. And I don't know, what I don't know, right, is whether that's just a female propensity to plan ahead more, or if there's something else that goes with that.
Yeah, we don't want to start a war of the genders. We want to be politically correct here, of course, but I'm just wondering, you know, if women might care more about their employees' futures. And, you know, a lot of times that's what legacy businesses are all about, is they don't want the culture that they've built up carefully over the years to change for a financial transaction. So I was just wondering if you had any feedback or thoughts about that.
I think that culture is definitely a big element of what I see with my women business owners, that there's a very strong focus on creating that, maintaining it, and making sure that it's going to continue into the future.
Yeah, that's would be my inclination. So that's what I was wondering, and I haven't seen statistics to that effect either yet. When you work with business owners, what are the three biggest value driver elements or things that grow their business that business owners you find often overlook?
So there's certainly three. There's more than this, but these are the ones that I find to be two things. One, the most common, and then secondly, the one that have the most bang for the buck. So the first one is really having an employee structure that fills the key processes of, for lack of a better way to put it, right, like a fleshed out organizational chart. The opposite of this is what I call the VIP owner. So if you have an owner that's serving a critical value role, i.e. they're the face of the company, they're the main salesperson, they're the ones that answer all of the questions and dictate all of the operations, those are value minimizers. And having an employee organization that really covers those key things is important to the value of the company. And there's a couple of reasons for that, but certainly one of them is that it gives you multiple opportunities for who you might sell your company to. If an owner has to replace themselves with somebody that has very specific skill sets, then the population of who they can sell their company to is going to be greatly minimized. And the value, therefore, is also going to be minimized.
Let's talk about that one for a second, because that's a common area that we find in a lot of smaller and even emerging mid-sized businesses, is the owners have a complex job, right, structure.
Yeah.
They do a lot, and then they build support around themselves a lot of the time. And, you know, when you think about like a CPA like yourself, who, you know, that's you. That's your expertise. You've built your practice around you, or even doctors and other service professionals, small attorneys. I think a lot of people struggle with that in that, you know, well, I don't have enough budget to keep hiring employees until I don't have anything to do. And if I don't have anything to do, then what am I doing?
Right, right. Yeah. And
so, it's a tough one.
And you want to make sure that you're still profitable for all kinds of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But like
so
you say, if you don't replace yourself, if you don't replace yourself, then you're never going to sell your business because there's nothing to sell but you and your services.
That's right. And I think the balance in replacing yourself is doing it in a smart way. So what is the critical value element? And I'll use an extreme example just for sake of illustration, right? So if we have a business owner who is doing the bookkeeping and is the primary salesperson, well, what they need to do is replace themselves as the primary salesperson. And it doesn't have to be done years and years ahead of when they plan to sell. It just needs to be in place as they get ready to sell. Whereas a function like bookkeeping, that's very easy for somebody else to pick up. It doesn't have to be transitioned until the sale itself mm-hmm. happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good point. Okay, so that was your number one. I'm sorry I interrupted, but that's such an important point. I wanted to make sure our listeners heard your expert advice there.
The second one is what I'll refer to as customer diversification. And there's several different ways to think about this. The classic one is that, you know, customer A is 50% of my sales. So that's, and it's to a name, right? It's that other company or that person, whatever the case may be. But the other things that business owners may want to consider when it comes to diversification is geography. Depending upon the company that you have, you may not be able to diversify outside of a certain geography because it's a retail location, or using your example, it's a doctor where somebody needs to come visit them. But there are times where you can geographically diversify, and that certainly has benefits to it. Other types of diversification are customer type. So a lot of our customers are construction or construction-related companies, and so we like to see a mix of residential versus commercial, big, really large companies, as well as smaller companies. So having different types of customers, and all of those things come into play because they can help companies currently and in the future better weather changes in the economy. So you don't have all of your customers moving the same direction at the same time, whether that's increasing their buying from you or decreasing their buying from you.
That's a great tip, great point. And a lot of people are stuck with, maybe they get a huge client and that becomes a large part of their business. And they think, well, it's going to take all we can do just to keep up with orders from that particular customer, and they might stop thinking about diversification. But boy, if they ever lose that big customer, they're in a world of hurt.
Yeah, and one other, and I know this isn't, we're not really talking about buying a business, but one other point that I want to make about that, and it ultimately it impacts the value, but it also impacts a business owner's ability to sell their company because the buyer may not be able to buy it, in that there are certain, if a buyer has to get financing to buy the company, there are certain loan requirements around that. And some of those are tied to whether you have a concentration on your customer. So there are some downstream benefits to diversifying your customer base that you may not think about in the immediate near term.
Excellent. So employee structure and client diversification or customer diversification, what's number three?
Number three, near and dear to my heart, right, is what I call the cleanliness of the financial statements. And, you know, lots of small business owners, mid-sized business owners, have a lot of personal expenses that they run through the business. And there's nothing at all wrong with that. And that could be anything from the owner's salary to bill, you know, to their health insurance and maybe some travel, right? So there's all of, and they're very, very common. But the ability to separate those and to identify those as expenses that the business wouldn't have going forward after a sale is important. And the other thing that's important is that there's just that, you know, we can see when the customers are being invoiced. We know where the revenue's coming from. We know that the bank accounts are being reconciled. And it's something that a lot of business owners may or may not be aware of that they need to be on top of before they list their company. But one of the things that we've seen is having all of that information in order as they get to listing their company and getting into an offer stage just provides a huge amount of credibility with the buyer right out of the gate, right? So if you don't have your tax returns ready, if you don't have your financial statements in order, you're going to lose some credibility with your buyer immediately on stuff that they're going to think is pretty easy and pretty common. And now they could start to be a little questioning of some of the other information. So we want to minimize that and make the process as smooth as possible. And the best time to do it is when you're getting ready.
Really good points. Really good points. Now, I have one question around that, because we hear more and more about the attractiveness of reoccurring revenues. Everybody's headed towards that. I mean, everybody who can is putting subscription-based, you know, fee structures in. For instance, I bought a printer from HP not too long ago, and they sold me a subscription for the ink, you know, so they get $10 a month instead of waiting for me to run out of ink. Is it important to delineate that, or is it helpful to delineate reoccurring revenue streams on your financial statements from just general? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely, and that is an excellent point. So, you know, one of the things that buyers really like to see is some sort of pipeline or some sort of consistency in the revenue stream to where it's not, I have to go out and drum up 100% new customers all the time. Because, you know, there's no guarantee that you're going to be able to drum up 100% new customers all of the time. So having some sort of recurring revenue stream, whether that's contractual, or whether it's just recurring by nature of the fact that there's, like your printer ink, right? Like, you're not going to be able to use that printer you bought if you don't have ink. And what companies are trying to do is, we're making it easier for the consumer so they don't have to worry about buying their ink. But at the same time, the company itself is also solidifying when they can expect you to buy ink. The other related recurring revenue, if you want to call it that, are contracts, right? So if you have contracts with customers that are longer term in nature, right, a 3-year contract to provide IT support services, you know, a 5-year contract to do all of the maintenance on buildings, those types of things are also highly valuable because you've got a contracted price, you've got a contracted customer, you've got specifics around how and when they can exit the contract. There may be built-in price increases. You know, real estate, while we're not really talking about that, is an excellent example of a long-term contract, right? You have leases in place for part of the building at specific rates. You know, so that's a very old-school way of thinking about contracted income, but, you know, it can apply to a number of businesses.
Great, great tips. Wonderful talking with you, and I'm really enjoying our conversation. Unfortunately, as often happens, we're reaching the end of our interview without really scratching the surface on a lot of the things that you can talk about. So I hope that you'll come back and join us again, Jennifer. But before you go, tell our listeners the best way that they can get in touch with you or what your website address and what they might find there in the next minute or two.
Sure. So our website address is peakadvisory.com. That's P as in Paul, EEK advisory. We're Peak Advisory Group, and there's a contact form there. There's our certainly our contact information. You can call us directly. You can also connect with me individually on LinkedIn. I'm at Jennifer J. Peak is the specific LinkedIn, but you'll find me there. Last name is P as in Paul, E-E-K. We like to say it's Peekaboo. It's an easy way for people to remember how to spell our last name. And those are the two best ways to get in touch with me and just find out more about the services we can provide. We have all ranges of businesses we work with. Some of our clients we work with on a longer-term basis, and some of them we work with on a project basis. The best way to find out how we can best help you is to just give us a call, because every company is unique.
You do a terrific job of explaining some very complex structures, and I really do hope that you'll come back and join me again someday soon, Jennifer. Thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to the next time we speak.
Thanks. I do as well. Have a great day.
All right. My next guest, first of all, thank you very much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. As you know, we interview a wide variety of advisors, authors, and other experts here at Exit Coach Radio. And my next guest is from Albuquerque, New Mexico. He is Terry White with SunWest Trust, Inc., also SunWest Escrow. And we're going to talk about SunWest Trust. They're a custodian for self-directed IRAs. So if you've wondered, you know, is there more that I can do with my IRA account out there, my 401k rollover, is there something more I can do than put it in the bank or put it into a mutual fund and hope and pray? We're going to find out about what some of those options might be. So, Terry, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Bill. I'm looking forward to it.
Same here. So, Terry, before we get started, tell us a little bit about your background and SunWest Trust and what you do there.
Well, Bill, that's a long story. We've been in business for 33 years, but the short version is I graduated from the University of New Mexico with a degree in accounting and had a real job for about 4 years, and then I left there and started the escrow company. And then over the years, an escrow company, for those of you that don't know, is basically a mortgage servicing company, but for owner financing. So we service accounts where owners have chosen to be the bank and just receive monthly payments on the sale of their real estate, as opposed to, you know, a lump sum like, you know, the majority of people do. And then in 2004, we decided that we needed to expand our business, and we became a trust company. And the only thing we do in the trust space is act as custodian for self-directed IRAs, like you said. So that's an exciting thing, because a lot of people, majority of people, I probably would say, don't realize that they can invest their individual retirement accounts in something other than stocks, bonds, and mutual funds, CDs, that kind of thing.
Which these days is a great opportunity to do some interesting things. And, of course, there are some restrictions as to what you can do. You can't own your own real estate, right? There are some restrictions. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about those. But first of all, why do people come to you? Why do people choose a self-directed IRA? What are they frustrated about or looking for?
Well, you know, that's probably as varied as the people that come to us. But I kind of feel like the main reason is that they're tired of letting other people determine the yield that they're going to get on their investment. So what I mean by that is, if I buy a share of stock in a national company, I'm at the complete mercy of the owner of or of the CEO of that company and of the market on Wall Street to determine how much I'm going to make. And it's also kind of an intangible thing. I mean, yeah, you could say I own a piece of Apple or Facebook or whatever, but do you really, you know, you can't go over there and say I own that chair or I own that desk or whatever. So
right.
Having a self-directed IRA gives people the ability to like really have a physical asset and know where it is and what it is.
So when people come and say, I want to put money into a self-directed IRA, do they usually have a pretty good idea what they want to do? Or is that something that, I mean, what you guys don't really make the investment recommendations. You just tell them whether it's okay or not and kind of like you said, you custody the asset of the IRA account for them, or take are their custodian. How does that work?
Well, so I would say, you know, I can't say in every case, because we do have people that like the idea of a self-directed IRA, but they don't know what they want to invest in. But I would say the majority of people that come to us already have in mind what they want to do. They want to buy a piece of real estate, or they want to invest with a friend of theirs that's starting a new business, that kind of thing. And I want to say right at the very beginning, I think it's important to note that self-directed IRAs are not for everyone, meaning, you know, if you're not familiar with investing and if you don't understand how the investment you're making is going to pay you a return, you probably shouldn't be doing it, and you should probably leave your money in the mutual funds or something where the professionals can that know how to make returns on that particular investment. But if for those people that understand investing, it's a great opportunity to have greater control over what their retirement account is invested in.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of great people that are satisfied with what they've done, and they're happy that they're not subject to, you know, the manipulation of the stock market or the dismal yields that are in bond accounts and others. So it gives them those alternative types of classes to invest in. Would you say most people, or a large percentage of people, do tend to gravitate towards real estate in self-directed IRAs?
Well, not really. You know, I'm just actually looking today at a list of kind of an overall list of the kinds of things people invest in with us. And closely held stock is a pretty large one. You know, limited liability companies, meaning they've got a friend or they know someone who's starting a business and they want to get invested in that. I'm told, and I don't know that it's true, but I'm told that part of the investment that helped start Facebook was from individual retirement accounts. So, you know, just as a if you had known Mark Zuckerberg back how many ever years ago, you know, and he said, "Hey, Bill, I'm getting ready to start this business. You know, I'm looking for investors." You could actually have taken part of your individual retirement account and invested it with him at the very beginning. And man, what kind of a return would that have been had you been one of those first people?
Yeah, I need a time machine. I can go back and do all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
So, what can let's say we talked about, you know, there's some restrictions with regards to self-dealing types of assets like real estate that you live in or businesses that you own. Those are off limits. But what else can people invest in a self-directed IRA?
Okay. Well, just real quick, the IRS does not tell you what you can invest in. What they do is they tell you what you cannot invest in. So as far as investment vehicles are concerned, they say you cannot invest in life insurance or collectibles. So other than those two things, every investment is available. The next thing they do is they say you can't do business with a person that's known as a disqualified party. And a disqualified party would be number one, you. So where you say your IRA can't own the real estate that you're living in. That's exactly correct. So you're a disqualified party. So your IRA can also not buy something from you. I get people calling every once in a while that say, "Hey, I want to start a self-directed IRA and I want to sell this piece of real estate that I have to my IRA." Well, you can't do that because you're a disqualified party. So you cannot sell anything to your IRA. The other people that are disqualified is your family. And interestingly enough, the IRS defines family just as your ascendants or descendants. So in other words, your parents, grandparents, kids, grandkids, that kind of thing. They are disqualified parties as to your IRA. Interestingly, though, brothers, cousins, you know, they're not. Brothers, sisters, cousins are not disqualified. And then the other people that are disqualified are service providers to your IRA. So there's not a lot of restrictions. Those are fairly simple. And there are millions of investments out there that people could do that they wouldn't be crossing those lines. It's interesting to me how many people want to try to figure out how to blur those lines. But, you know, my opinion is there's lots of things out there that you can invest in. Don't try to walk the thin line and potentially violate that disqualified disqualified party rule or something.
Yeah. So, one thing that's always puzzled me is that, with IRA accounts, rollover accounts, all that type of thing, you're required to start making a distribution. And in typical IRA accounts, at age 70 and a half, you start getting a statement of value from the custodian at the beginning of the year to tell you what your minimum distribution has to be for that year, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that must be the type of work that you do, but then if it's real estate, does that mean you then have to go get appraisals on real estate on an annual basis? Is that one of the pitfalls, or tell us what are some of the pitfalls of self-directed IRA?
That is a great question, because I think people run into that time of life. They make an investment at 68 years old, buy a piece of real estate, and then before you know it, you're 70 and a half, and you have to start taking money out. So our policy is at SunWest Trust is that we ask you every year for a third-party evaluation of the value of your account. So let's say you own a piece of real estate right now and you're under 70 and a half. That third-party evaluation can be as simple as print out the Zillow market value, and send that to us. And that's what we'll hold it on the books as. But once you turn 70 and a half and you're going to have that taxable event, meaning you're going to have to take out a portion of that money, then we're going to require an appraisal. So if you still own the real estate in your IRA, then that becomes a problem, because it's difficult. First of all, you have to get an appraisal, an actual appraisal from a certified appraiser. And then it's difficult to take out pieces of a house. So what I would encourage people to do is keep enough liquid assets in an individual retirement account somewhere to make those RMDs. And so just so they understand, when you turn 70 and a half, that doesn't mean you have to take everything out of the account. What happens is you look at the value of the account and you divide it by the remaining life expectancy of that person. And the idea is that you will take everything out and pay taxes on it before you pass away. So that might be a relatively small number. Today I think I've heard somewhere that, and I haven't looked at the universal life table in a while, but I think the life expectancy for a 70-year-old is like 86 years old. So you've got roughly 15 years to take that out. So that doesn't mean you have to sell that piece of real estate now, as long as you have some liquid cash in another account somewhere that you can take that RMD.
Right. Yeah. Honey, we can't use that bathroom anymore. It belongs to the IRS now.
Yeah.
That'd be a great cartoon series. So it sounds very interesting. It sounds like it's something that people should learn more about. And you help people learn about that. You have a book and other information at your website as well. So let's spend some time in the next few minutes telling people about how they can learn more about this, and maybe start with who's a good candidate. Is there a minimum balance where it starts to make sense? Let's hone in on that so our listeners can get a good sense on whether they should find out more and how.
Okay. Well, just real quick, most people are probably aware that you can contribute $5,500 a year. I wish $55,000. You can contribute $5,500 a year to an IRA, and if you're over 50, you can contribute $6,500. Well, as a practical matter, that's not enough money probably to invest in a self-directed IRA. So what we see is people that had 401ks at a previous employer or something, rolling those over into an IRA where they might have $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. Our average account is a little bit over $100,000. But what I would tell people to look at when trying to determine, if they want to do a self-directed IRA, is every self-directed IRA custodian charges a fee for the service of acting as custodian. So I would encourage your listeners to get on the internet and do some due diligence. Look at all the custodians out there. There's several out there. And look at their different fee structures. They all charge a different fee, and they charge their fees in different ways. So depending upon what you're thinking about investing in, one particular fee method or one you know, one method that the way a custodian charges might be more beneficial for the type of investment you're looking at making. But stop and think about that fee as a percentage of the money that you have in your account, because you're going to have to make enough return. You know, so if you have a, let's say you have, let's just make it easy for the math for me. Let's say you have $5,000 in your account and you're going to invest in something that's going to make you 20% return. Well, that sounds like a great return, 20%. But if you then look at it and say, okay, to have that $5,000 account at XYZ custodian, it's going to cost me $500 a year. Well, that's 10% right there. So that cuts your 20% return on the $5,000 down to 10% right off the bat when you're considering you have to pay those fees. Does that make sense to you? I mean, as far as how you would look at that?
Yeah, very much so. Different strokes for different folks. If you have a different orientation towards your self-directed IRA with the assets you're going to invest in, you might find a better arrangement at one custodian versus another. Makes perfect sense. And
yeah.
So
a lot of custodians. Well, I'm sorry. A lot of custodians. So at SunWest, we charge a flat fee of $275 a year, regardless of how many assets you have in your account or how big your account is. Other custodians might charge a fee per asset that you have in the account. They might charge a fee, a percentage fee, based on the value of your account. So just look at all those things and figure out what might, they might charge you a fee based on the number of transactions you do. You know, so you just need to look, know what you're going to invest in, and then look and figure out which custodian's fee structure might work best for you.
That's great advice. Now, tell us a little bit about your, you have a free book available on your website. What's that all about?
Well, so I've been in this business, specifically in the self-directed IRA business now for, I don't know, I actually started the first company that did this in 1995. So 24 years I've been in this business. And there were not very many books out there that talked specifically about self-directed IRAs. And some of them that did were on a pretty high level, so it was hard for people to understand. So basically my book is a layman's analysis of how a self-directed IRA works and what you might use it to invest in. And we just use it kind of as a glorified brochure. So if people are interested in that book, they can go to our website at sunwesttrust.com and they can get an e-book version of that, or they can actually request that we send them the book. And we're happy to provide that to people because we feel like an educated investor is a much better investor for us and for themselves, because they're going to do much better and have a much better experience if they're educated and know what they can do and how to do it. The other thing that we have available is I have over 250 videos on YouTube under the channel of SunWest IRA. And so they're all short 5-7 minute videos that talk about different aspects of IRAs and investing in IRAs, investing your IRA in various things. And so that's a great place for people to get started to even determine if a self-directed IRA is something they want to do.
Great stuff, Terry. And, you know, the statistics are pretty heavy. There are 10,000 people in the U.S. turning age 65 every day for the next several years. So there's a lot of people reaching retirement age, and actually people can reach into their 401ks in many cases earlier than that, depending on their 401k rules. And a lot of people are nervous about the market being too high or bond yields being too low. They might be looking for those alternative asset classes. So a great way to find out and learn more about it by going to sunwesttrust.com and looking up. And the name of the book, as I have it here, is When All You Have Is a Hammer, An Informational Guide to Self-Directed IRAs. So, Terry, thank you so much for joining me today. It was really interesting, and I really appreciate the knowledge you bring to our listeners.
Absolutely, Bill. Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
All right, so we're going to keep moving on. Again, welcome to Exit Coach Radio Show. My name is Bill Black, and I'm really happy that you're here. We interview dozens and dozens, actually over 1,000 now, advisors, authors, other experts on all things having to do with growing the value of your business as you head towards exit, or maybe dealing with difficult family transitions, maybe dealing with your wealth. And my next guest is R.C. Peck, and he's with Fearless Wealth, Chief Investment Officer there. They're in Kirkland, Washington, and he is in the business of training people and their money to be part of the big trends while avoiding the large recessionary losses that might come up. And we're going to talk today about humans and investing and why growing money is nothing like earning it. So, RC, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks.
My pleasure. So tell us a little bit about you and your background and how you came to start a company called Fearless Wealth and what you do there.
Yeah, so my background, I think, is a little different or unusual. My first big kind of introduction to money investing was coming home at 19 to see my parents crying in the family room because their financial advisor that they trusted and liked embezzled all of their money. And he embezzled everybody's money at the company. but I was focused on my parents' money. And so I come at this investing thing almost as a reformed cynic. And I'm a bit of a heretic, right? I don't really get along or play well with advisors or what I call the big box advisor world. And and because I kind of see or have seen how the way that this whole industry has been designed, it's been kind of designed on this whole thing called, I'm going to use a lot of words you don't know. I'm going to use a lot of jargon. You're going to feel scared and overwhelmed, but then I'm going to swoop in as your hero and take care of you based on the scared feelings, confused feelings I just created in your body. And I think that's a really weird relationship. And so I come at this, you know, differently, unusually, outspokenly. And so that's my background. And I come at it really from a behavioral point of view, because all of our choices, before we ever make a choice, they're first a behavior or a feeling in our body. Even if we don't feel it consciously, it starts with us and how we're behaving or feeling.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But what you're saying is true. I think the big box investment firms adopt a hurt and rescue kind of a sales strategy, right? They want to help you, like you said. They want to hurt you, like make you afraid, and then rescue you, come to your rescue, be your hero. But there's also so many people that had so much implied trust, like you take a Bernie Madoff, right, who was had such a storied career and had so much trust built in, and came in and swooped away with a lot of people's money too. So it's no mystery that investors are afraid of trusting big box and little box these days. So what do we do about that?
Well, it may sound a little weird, but I don't think if people have to trust their advisor, that is a big problem. Now, you probably want to like the people that are in your life, but when you have to trust them, that's a problem. And so it's because we've been taught to be confused, we've been taught to be overwhelmed, and we've been taught to say, okay, go find someone you like and trust. So to answer your question, look, I'm biased here. People aren't trained. People have not been trained to look at their money, to visually understand their money, right? Our brains are pattern recognition machines, visual pattern recognition machines, right? When something was in the deep grass 10,000 years ago, our prefrontal lobes weren't having, oh, well, it may be a large animal. No, our body said,
right.
get out.
Run or die.
Our brain. Run or die. And the ones that didn't aren't here. You don't know any of them. They didn't make it, 100 more generations. And still today, even in 2019, our brains are designed to see patterns, visual patterns. So when you don't put a deliberate picture in front of your brain, whether it's you feel it consciously or not, it's going to make a picture up. Right. So if I say to you, oh, my gosh, the P/E ratio is 27. The last time it was 27 was 2000 before the dot-com crash or the 2008 global financial crisis or 1929. So I could just pause there. That person's body, the cortisol level is going up. Their limbic system's been turned on. And I don't mean to use these words, but like already the brain and the body of that person is in this fight or flight. Now, no one's shown them any pictures, but they have loaded up pictures or images or feelings in their body. And imagine making an investment decision thinking there's a lion around the corner or a tiger or a bear, and now you have to make a decision with your 500,000 or million or even 100,000. We know from science, we humans make pretty bad choices when we think we're about to be attacked. But that's what the big box world and the pick of the month newsletter world has basically done. They've taught us to make these choices unconsciously, not getting that we are in this state of fear. And so, in answering your question, it's get a picture. I mean, there's a lot to this, like what type of picture RC, all these things, but we're already loading pictures up. Let's deliberately put an image in front of someone and say, okay, set the words aside. Do you want to buy this thing? And no one is training us to do that.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. I think there's like what you're saying, which I really like, is the investor has to take accountability by the horns and train themselves. And I think a lot of people are like, well, guess what? I don't have time. I'm good at what I do at my job, but it has nothing to do with all this financial stuff. And it's gotten so complicated, probably because the industry's made it that way, like you're saying, that I don't have time. So do people, is that true, or is there a way for people to carve out time and learn? And I think that's what you're going to tell us, right?
Yeah, and I mean, thanks for the question, because it's one of the questions I hear a lot. So I have a bunch of things flooded my brain. So the first thing is, imagine if you came to me and said, RC, I don't have time to have a good marriage. I mean, I'm busy, I got kids, I got a wife or a husband, I got a job. I just don't have the time to have a great life. I just don't have time to have a great marriage. Now, you said investing, but go with me. So that's one thing, right? The second thing is, people have been taught that being smart with your money is based on effort and time, right? But we've all had the experience where we've driven our car off the car lot, and all of a sudden, our brain sees all the other VW bugs or Ford F-150s on the road. That didn't take time. That didn't take effort. Our brain naturally wants to do this, but we've been taught to turn away. Like, literally, we've been taught. Imagine you went to the ocean, like to the beach, and there's the big box world and the pick of the month world, and they say, oh, turn around. No, turn around, Bill. Turn around. Don't look. And all of a sudden, your back's to the ocean, and you hear crashing waves. That's probably kind of a stressful situation. The great thing about money and growing money, which is very different from earning it for the most part is based on effort, right, to a certain point. And growing money hates effort. In fact, the more effort, I mean, you have to put a baseline amount of attention on your money, but it's surprising how little that is. So people go in thinking, well, those guys have full-time jobs, and I got a full-time job. I can't do another full-time job. Like, yeah, I got it. But they're actually not doing what you want to do. If you turn around and look at the water, it's not based on effort. So it's a fair question, because most people do believe, I just don't have the time. And the great news is it's not based on time or effort. Yes, you have to carve out a little time, actually not that much. But once you train your brain, you actually can't untrain it. Like, you can't stop looking at all the VW bugs on the road. You just naturally see them, right? You can't go, stop finding them, stop finding the other cars that look like mine. You can't undo that. So it's actually right. not difficult to train the brain to see the patterns to get you the control you want with your future.
Yeah, that makes sense. So with the training that you're talking about, and does it follow a particular methodology? What do you when you say training people to either recognize good opportunities or maybe bad opportunities, is it basically based on the fundamentals of investing? Is and how much time does it take?
So the second thing I train people to do is to get a picture of what they are investing in. And I'm just going to make up two really black and white examples. So someone says, I want to buy GE. GE is a great company. It's got a great turnaround story, blah, blah, blah. So the second thing I do is train them to get the right picture to look at. And the picture I want them to look at is a picture of the price of the GE stock, right? Because you're not buying GE the company, you're buying GE the stock. And so your portfolio is going to go up and down, up or down based on the stock. And Newton kind of figured this investment stuff out about 400 years ago, that something in motion will stay in motion until something of equal and opposite force pushes against it. So GE's been falling for 2 decades. All right, so let's just assume 2 decades is a long time. That's a train that's been moving a long time. So I train people to get a visual representation. And most people are actually taught to look at price the wrong way or too short or in ways that it doesn't benefit them. So it's to get that picture, which the brain wants. As far as the time, literally my training is 8 weeks. Which is very surprising to a lot of people because most people are in their 40s or 50s or 60s. And so they're making this assumption it's going to take quarters and years and, you know, tens and tens and tens or hundreds of hours because, again, they've been taught that it's effort-based. But literally in, you know, single-digit hours spread across 8 weeks because – their brain has to get also hit with something called Monday, right? You got to get hit with Monday, and then Monday hits you again, and then Monday hits you again, which is called life. And you still got to make sure your brain can see what it's supposed to see. So by spreading out those hours over 8 weeks, the brain very quickly gets trained, again, going back to the car metaphor, to see the car you want to see. And it's like, oh, got it. And then it can't be undone.
Interesting. It's very interesting, and I'm looking at your website right now, and there's a lot of great information there to help people kind of get an overview or idea. And you also have things like free webinars and other interesting information. Who do you think, besides everyone, who do you think specifically should be thinking about this? Is there a profile of a person in your mind that you're thinking is the perfect person for this?
Yeah, so thanks for that. And it absolutely is not everyone. I've been training people for 2 decades. And so more people are not a fit than are. But I'll tell you some just general characteristics of people who may notice themselves wanting to know more. So the first is they've maybe been with the big box advisor world and even the pick of the month newsletter world, and they're kind of getting that they may not be helping me or maybe even be hurting me. So that typically means they have to be older or at least have enough experience with both of those two worlds. The second thing is they have to be making enough money to know that making more money is not specifically the answer. Right. So someone who's making $30,000 a year, they'll think what I'm saying is arrogant and it'd be upsetting to them because $30,000 isn't enough, at least in the U.S. and certainly isn't in, you know, Silicon Valley or Seattle. But someone who's making $150,000, right, or maybe $80,000 or $100,000 in maybe deep Mississippi where things are less money, but they're making enough to know, okay, I'm making the money I thought I needed to make to be, air quotes, rich. Okay, so now what? I don't feel like I'm any closer to acquiring the choice to not have to work. So there's this general income of them recognizing earning is not enough. And that can only happen by earning whatever they think is enough. Typically, it's six figures. But I'd say the last thing is this desire to want to be trained or look at something differently. And typically, it kind of shows up as bad news, right? Like, because people are going to get trained on things that go against what they might currently believe. The stock market is dangerous. No, it's not. Yeah, if you're out on the ocean with 50-foot waves, of course it is. But what the heck are you doing out on the ocean with 50-foot mm-hmm. waves? Same thing with the stock market. The bond market is not safe, just any more than the stock market is dangerous. So it's people who are recognizing something's off. My big box advisor let my money get cut in half twice. To pick up the month newsletter world, you know what? They're actually scaring me. And then swooping in saying, hey, I know I just scared you, but let me solve that scaredness for you. And so there's a level of recognition, like something's got to change, and it's not more of the same. It's not another big box. It's not another ticker symbol. It's not another newsletter. It's not another book. What's the commonality that hasn't shifted? Now, they might not say, oh, I got to get trained, because that no one thinks that. Right? No one's like, oh, I probably should get trained. It's not something anyone ever thinks. But the way we grow our money sits on top of how we behave. How we behave sits on top of how we feel. How we feel sits on top of what we've been trained to do with those feelings.
That's great information. It's wonderful. It really is. It's refreshing, and it makes, you know, it's encouraging people to take back the accountability and stop getting shifted around to different advisors who may or may not have their best interests. There's a lot written on this these days about in whose best interest not only is the advisor working in, but the firm that they work for. And so it's really important that investors start to take back the onus of accountability on their own behalf. And again, in looking at your site, there are great testimonials on here from a lot of different people. There are audio examples and testimonials and great ways to get started on learning about what this is all about. So I encourage everybody to that is listening to this, take accountability, learn about this stuff, because the markets are really, I'd say, more controlled than ever by forces beyond our comprehension. And it's really important for people to take back and learn what that's all about. Now, RC, when people come on to here, it looks like they can have things like conversations with you to figure out their investment blind spots and things like that. Tell our listeners what that kind of a call might go like.
Yeah, so here's something really weird and unusual about me, especially because most of my clients I never meet in person. One of the first things I ask of people is that we get on a phone call, right? And this is very daunting to a lot of people. I mean, I have to talk about my money to a stranger. Like, you want to talk about scary. People would rather talk about their weight or their marital problems, but not their money. So I know if someone's like, look, I'll talk about my money. If someone's willing to have a conversation, it's obviously a safe conversation. It tells me that they're open and they're like, look, I'm committed. Now, my conversations are different. I'm not going to ask them their age and their self-described risk tolerance, because we've all been taught our age matters most. Isn't that interesting? Like, the stock market doesn't care the year you were born. Does not care how you answer those 12 questions
right.
that big box advisor, you know, said no ocean ever. How old's that guy over there? Nope. You're in the ocean, 50-foot waves, he's dead.
Right.
But we've
right.
been taught that. Life is about us and the year we were born and how we answer those 12 questions. So it's a refreshing conversation in the sense that it's jargon free. And wow, I'm talking about money in a way that I haven't before, to really understand what is in the blind spot. And no one can see their own blind spot. You can't. I don't care if you're 50, 60, 70. I don't care if you've been in the markets one day or 30 years, we have blind spots. And it's someone else who has to be able to go, oh, I see what you're doing, because I'm not in your blind spot. And so that phone conversation, whether they move forward or not, is it's an experience that they've never had before and has them go, wait a second. They'll either go, I want more of this, tell me more. They'll go, yeah, not for me. But it's very kind of go, no go, because they're super clear about what life can be taking back control of their money. They're like, okay, I can do this, yeah. And that's the easiest next step, is to have a conversation.
Great information. R.C. Peck, Fearless Wealth. The website is fearlesswealth.com. And I would encourage you, again, to check that out, because there's a lot of great information. There's ways to learn more about what R.C. Does, and book a phone call to start taking accountability for your own actions out there in the investment world. So, R.C., thank you so much for joining us today. Really enjoyed the conversation and look forward to the next time we speak.
Thanks, Bill. Take care.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us today. That's going to do it for our show. Really enjoyed having you here at Exit Coach Radio, and I look forward to talking with you again in about a week.
Hey, everybody. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now.